Let's talk to our political commentators now. Today it's Stephen Mills, who is with us, I think, by Zoom today. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Catherine.
And Ben is in the Tamaki Makaurau Auckland studio. Kia ora, Ben.
Morena.
Stephen is the executive director of UMR Research, which is the polling firm used by Labor. He's a former political advisor to two Labor governments. Ben Thomas is a PR consultant and a former national government press secretary. Okay, the bubble burst pretty much, didn't it, late last week with decisions for New Zealanders to try and get home over the next week to avoid having to go back into managed isolation. The images out of Sydney were pretty sobering, watching the protests happening as it tries to enforce now a very strict lockdown. What are the implications of this for us here? Who wants to go first?
Here you go, Ben.
Yeah, well, it was probably inevitable that they would, draw the curtain on the bubble for the next 8 weeks and in all likelihood a little bit longer while the Australian states get their acts together. There's too much uncertainty over there in terms of whether people who didn't know they were infected or people who had been close contacts could have gotten out, slipped through to other states who could then, find their way to New Zealand through the sort of porous border that we had in place with the bubble. So, I don't think that there was anything sort of radical or surprising about the government's, reaction to that. It does, unavoidably, it signals a sort of further retreat back from the world, but it does bring into sharp focus, the speed of the vaccine rollout. Australia is much more susceptible than it otherwise would be because they're in pretty much the same boat as us with vaccinations. And, we've seen in the past week infection rates have fallen off a cliff in the UK. They've dropped, hugely. And that's a result of, vaccinating a great deal of their population. The Delta variant, as we know, is much more infectious. So the government will be thinking about, what does this mean for the prospects, of another lockdown here if something slips through MIQ. As Sydney showed, as London showed during this day of action by, wackos who are either sort of, I think in London they were protesting about the sort of satanic basis of the vaccination program. In Sydney they were just a bit more sort of, ochre, larrikin, won't be told what to do and be in lockdown. But, this social license, this social consent to lock up the entire population really does seem to be waning worldwide, and that won't have escaped the government's attention.
Well, especially with the lockdowns, first Melbourne had at least three, I think, and now Sydney back into it again as well. What they're seeing, and undoubtedly what they're hearing, and not to mention their confidence that the contact tracing system could possibly catch up with and clamp down on an outbreak of the Delta here, Stephen, what do you think the calculations are?
Well, I think, just to kind of, it's an absolute no-brainer. And I mean, the stakes with Delta are obviously really high. So the closing of the bubble was, obviously had to be done. Things aren't under control in New South Wales. And who knows whether that march of the demented will lead to much higher rates over the next few days in New South Wales as well. I think it's also very sensible that we're reopening, as Grant Robertson announced over the weekend, on an all-of-Australia approach. There's recurrent examples of Australians breaking their rules, and those land borders there are obviously much more easily breached than an air border. I mean, I think the whole kind of experience with New South Wales, she's been the boldest premier slash sort of prime minister across Australia and New Zealand, keeping an eye to, what business needed rather than to the health outcomes, and she's been too slow to close and then too soft. And she's basically painfully got to a New Zealand-style lockdown, apart from the demonstrators, of course, at a huge cost. And on the vaccination, clearly both countries, are, got low levels compared to others, but there seems to be considerable confidence. I mean, it will depend on what happens with Delta, I guess, whether it gets into New Zealand or not, which will change things, clearly, but that the ramping up that's been long promised is underway and will be successful.
It's going to have its own controversies, that, Ben, because we know RNZ reporting only 20%, I think, of those in Group 3 have had their vaccinations at around about, this was last week, at around about the time it's set to open up to an even broader audience. And look, there's two streams of thought here, isn't it? If you're now at the point where we've got enough vaccines coming in, and it is increasing, and Chris Hipkins talking about now getting up to 200,000 and ultimately up to 300,000 a week, you don't want to be slowing anything down in order to go back and catch up on the ones you've missed. Alternatively, the worry is that the people who are most vulnerable, either at the border or who are because of age or underlying health conditions, clearly many of them are still unvaccinated. Do you think they will likely just go on with a full court press and try and get those numbers up as high as possible? And again, will the problem be if their luck runs out on an incursion?
Yeah, that's the risk. The real risk is the timing of any outbreak. The vaccination at the border seems to have really clamped down on outbreaks from MIQ. We haven't had a significant one for a long time, you know, since, what,
February? There are still unvaccinated people working in various positions, not strictly, I guess, in the MIQ facilities.
No, but at the
ports.
There
are still gaps, exactly.
And they won't be vaccinated until September, which seems like, you know, sort of unconscionable dragging of the feet, I would have thought. The other thing we discussed over the weekend, police not vaccinated, they'll probably want to get their jabs before we have any lockdown protests. The sequencing, in a way, it is pretty important, in the sense that while it's fine if there's a free-for-all and we get 40% of people, 50% of people rushing in to get vaccinated as fast as possible, and they'll all be, you know, middle-class people who are constantly looking at the Beehive website or watching the daily updates like me, that's good. Anyone getting vaccinated is a net good for the community and the public. The problem is that the reason we have a national vaccine rollout rather than just making it free for anyone who wants to turn up and instead having a campaign is that just by getting people like me and the people listening to a half-hour politics slot on RNZ in the morning, you won't actually get to those vulnerable populations, particularly rural, particularly poorer, particularly Māori. I mean, you know, the South Auckland figures and Māori and Pacifica have actually been really lagging behind in Auckland, and they're actually the ones at most risk, you know, out by the airport in Mangere. And you know, so the problem is that we get kind of lulled into a sense of complacency as things do ramp up in terms of the statistics, as everybody who now becomes eligible for their Group 4 vaccination rushes in, and we lose sight of, you know, those vulnerable people, that last mile, who are actually the important ones to reach.
And many of whom are older and are voters and are pretty hacked off at the moment. To your point about the Māori and Pacifica, that was where Dr. Rāwhiti Jansen resigned from one of the vaccination rollout advisory groups, saying, if I cannot get the importance of prioritising right back around Group 1, this population, then what am I going to get over the line? Stephen, it seems to me that they need to, and this is the other thing, the GPs now... GPs have been calling for months and months and months to know where they're going to be in the lineup here. I think Dr. Ashley Bloomfield told me last time I interviewed him, perhaps 40% of GP practices were going to be involved in this. I mean, they're the ideal people to chase up their older clients. They do it with the flu vaccine. They say the flu vaccines have arrived. We are prioritising our older clients first. But again, we just seem to be so slow in getting the systems going, Stephen.
Well, I agree that the GPs are an ideal way to make sure you kind of mop up those who are otherwise missed out. But I mean, everybody seems that I've talked to seems very pleased with the progress that's been made, and particularly over the weekend. You know, all invitations that are out now to Group 3, and they've, you know, everybody that could be contacted should have a code now, and that's been supplemented by the 0800 line. And while there will be some overlap, presumably that Group 3 will have their appointments before Group 4 start booking on Wednesday. But I mean, it is a huge thing, and there will be some anomalies and people missed out, and they have to be kind of chased up and tracked down. I mean, I think that... the kind of jury's probably out on it politically, and it will be dependent on whether Delta gets in or not. You know, if they get through to that target, you know, of everybody who wants to be vaccinated by the end of the year, I think the government will look measured and capable, and its COVID credentials will be burnished. But if it gets in, and that could be just pure bad luck, I think it's going to be hard to explain, you know, why vaccination didn't go faster. But the supply does seem to be coming through, and the staff are there now. So I think, you know, that there is progress being made. And, you know, we're certainly kind of better off in terms of, you know, the kind of public support for where things are than in Australia. The jury is in there, and their verdict is that, you know, Morrison's got it badly wrong, and his apology, I'm sure, was prompted by devastating research rather than anything else. You know, he's been seen to have kind of overexcited expectations, which hasn't happened here. There's been mixed and changing messages and total confusion over AstraZeneca. And in New Zealand too, I think, you know, I saw, I mean, this is just kind of what I saw in the news, but, you know, the mass events are kind of being prepared in South Auckland, which will presumably lift the rates amongst Maori and Pacifica. And there was rural task forces heading out as well. There was an item on in Eke Tahuna the other day as well. So, you know, I think kind of like progress is being made on all fronts, and you know, the outcomes, I guess, will be seen over the next couple of weeks. You know, if that booking system seems to be working as well, there are widespread predictions that would crash and burn. But I haven't seen any kind of complaints that that's happened yet either.
All right. Let's move forward. I think the consensus has been every week for a long time that for as long as things hold, political upsides are with the government. But if we were to end up in Sydney's situation, or if we end up having to go to a very high-level lockdown very quickly because the variant got going here, that might cause a very different mood about the place.
Everyone is very happy while Delta is something outside New Zealand's border. Nobody minds the sort of contraction of New Zealand's kind of horizons on the world.
All right.
But I think it's also got more difficult on the kind of COVID front in terms of the politics. So I think people think we're heading to the finishing line. Even with the example of Australia, you know, we've kind of a long way now from 2020, when the kind of political frame was Labor keeps us safe and National doesn't care. People aren't scanning. They're not going in for tests. There was, you know, really good sort of work done by stuff on that over the weekend. And, you know, in the testing in New Plymouth, where there seems to be evidence that some issue has been very low as well. So, you know, the danger is still there, but I don't think people are kind of activated as anything like they were, you know, last year on these issues. It's almost like they've had enough despite what they see on television in Australia.
I think the public of New Zealand is basically George Bush on the aircraft carrier declaring victory.
I think that's a great analogy.
Look, to be honest, I know what you're saying, but, you know, just out having some sunshine for the first time in quite a while when I've been able to get out in yesterday, the mood of people. This is a physical health issue primarily, but there's also a mental health issue that's part of the exhaustion that's caused some of the backlash you're seeing in the UK and possibly in Australia. And, you know, how much you want to credit it to luck and how much you want to talk about not having a pathway out of this, I think the actual mood of people with the freedoms we've had is immeasurable. I guess the point we're making is that's a different thing from saying we're not going to have a serious problem with this variant at some point. That could still happen and nobody should be in any doubt about that. But if people are making the most of the absence of it, that has got to be feeding into good news for any incumbent government. I want to talk about the policing matter, though, because this has just been building and building. Some months ago, I was talking about whether the gang issues that are happening, the shootings and the incidents that were happening, I recall Napier in particular, on, you know, popular sporting parks or in a McDonald's in Taradale. We are seeing more and more of these incidents. We know there is clearly a problem with a different style of gang emerging, recruiting fairly vigorously, and just generally taking a different approach to the use of firearms, actually. Is this a building sleeper issue, Ben?
Well, I think it's here already. I mean, the mongrel mob / Kahukura program funding is now into what, its second full week of coverage. The Prime Minister was answering questions about it this morning on her media round. So, you know, I think that's very fortuitous for the opposition. You know, this is the sort of perfect storm for Judith Collins in terms of fitting with her brand, in line with National sort of recent sort of populist kind of approach, and actually something that resonates with a lot of New Zealanders. You know, the sort of stage one sociology idea that, you know, gangs are a byproduct of colonialism and they're an alternative whānau or a provider or whatever doesn't actually get a lot of traction outside of online. And when you talk about, yeah, the increase in crime, you know, especially gun crime, this is the sort of thing that really weighs on the public's mind. You know, the gang shooting in Napier and Ahuriri, I mean, that's sort of like, that's like a gang shootout in Takapuna, You know, that's not sort of the back blocks or away from polite society. That's firmly leafy suburbs territory. And we've seen, you know, firearms discharged near the viaduct in Auckland, actually a couple of those. And, you know, I think this is the sort of thing that starts to register with the public, you know, for right or wrong. I don't think the public minds when gang violence is out of sight and out of mind. But when it's starting to present a sort of clear and random danger to them, you know, things change.
Stephen?
No, I agree with that. I agree with that analysis generally. I mean, I've always thought that kind of how hard you beat the law and order drum is the sort of second strongest kind of indicator of lack of integrity of a politician, narrowly behind the number of flags they have at press conferences. But I think we're going to hear a lot more of it. I mean, I think the Judith Collins strategy is really going to feature law and order and gangs. I think her kind of aim is to stay in the leadership, and to do that, I think she is going to throw red meat to the base. She's criticised a lot for not kind of appealing to the kind of Labor middle voter that National lost. But, you know, it's easiest for her to get her numbers up by inflaming on race, you know, building fear around law and order, and that's kind of obviously related, and amplifying discontent. And then when she's secure, you know, if she gets to a sort of situation where maybe Labor's in the sort of mid-40s, 44 or something, at Green's on 9, that she's on her magic 35 number, and, you know, ACT's maybe about 9, well, then she can think about whether she, you know, tax back to the centre. But I think we're going to get a lot more, you know, probably going to be more on law and order than for many elections in New Zealand.
I think broadly that's correct, except that I think it's wrong to say that law and order, you know, when you're having public gang shootouts, I think it's incorrect to say that that's, you know, merely a kind of right-wing base issue. I think that's the sort of thing that really starts to concern median voters.
No, fair point.
Yeah, I agree. Yes, you could get some votes from Labor on those issues as well.
Okay, let's look at... Sorry, Stephen?
No, you go, Catherine.
I was just going to say, let's look at ACT then, because it's been very, very active. I can tell you now, the media statements arrive about 4 to the hour. But also, I think, did it have a regional conference last weekend, or perhaps a conference last weekend? It's released a suite of policies, and it's being very ambitious in its target for, I think, doubling its number of MPs. Now, Ben, is this the classic case of great ambition, but as soon as the major party, and when the major party begins to recover its numbers, yours can deflate as quickly as possible? Or do they have an opportunity here to really build a smaller party up to a size we've not seen for quite some years, probably going back to the 90s, where they easily hit double figures, some of them? Is there an opportunity for it here, or is it really a matter of time because it's essentially scrapping over the same turf?
Long term, you would not think that ACT is probably a 20 MP party. We've seen that time and time again. The trend in MMP has actually been towards a consolidation of the vote for those centre-right and centre-left parties, National and Labor. And the sort of, you know, we've seen a revolving door of smaller parties. The Alliance, which was once touted as poised to take over from Labor as the natural party of the centre-left, you know, is now, you know, another, you know, political party in the graveyard of MMP. So long-term, you know, I don't think that they're a realistic chance for, you know, having 20 MPs in every parliament. They could, I think, you know, get back to that position they were in the 2000s, where they keep this sort of level of MPs on average, you know, over a number of terms. And I think, you know, if National doesn't get its act together, they will almost certainly increase their vote in the coming election. I'm not sure if they would double it, although that's not, you know, out of the question. You know, like you said, you know, in terms of the speed with which they respond to things, it's really a function of this very small core of people that I think we talked about last week, you know, who were the whole ACT team in the previous parliamentary term. And they're just used to doing this stuff at sort of such speed that, you know, a larger party like National can't actually
compete.
Are
they data savvy too? And I'm not talking data savvy in terms of social media messaging, but data savvy in terms of analysing where your votes are.
They've always done a lot of polling and research. They know exactly where their votes are coming from, their future votes. It was suggested, I think, in a news story on TVNZ that, you know, National were copying ACT because they're press releases would come out a couple of hours later or the next day with very similar messaging. I think it's wrong to say they would be copying on a per press release basis. You know, there's, having been in that position of putting up political press releases, you know, the wells of creativity aren't high, and you're generally choosing between being concerned or outraged about anything.
Yeah, but you're not off at the cafe having a coffee and a natter, is the point, isn't it?
But what I think it points towards is that National, you know, I think we know are not doing their own internal polling. And there's every possibility that they're just sort of looking over at ACT, who are, and sort of going, well, that's where the votes are. If they're going that way, then that's probably the right way to go, you know, in terms of consolidating that right-wing vote.
Stephen. I questioned it last week as well, whether National are doing focus groups. I mean, obviously, Judith Collins doesn't want the embarrassment. It is always, I think, ridiculous to say your own numbers are more significant than anyone else, but it does seem to be the case. But, you know, are National still doing kind of research on understanding the political mood through focus groups? I'd be surprised if they weren't. You know, look, I think ACT could go and probably will go on a bit of a polling tear. You know, as you pointed out, Catherine, New Zealand First and Alliance had surges into the 30s and the 1990s, which you never quite realised. ACT's highest, actually, in our polling is... they hit 12% in June 1998 on the wake of the good performance in the Taranaki King Country by-election. And they're 11% in our poll at the moment, so in our corporate subscriber poll at the moment. So they're not far off that. Prior to the 2017 election too, you had the situation where New Zealand First was on about 15, Greens were on about 15, and Labour was on 22 and falling fast. So I think it is possible that they can get through to the election. And the window is there with National's disarray, Judith Collins' popularity low, and the shine coming off the government at the moment. And, you know, it seems kind of weird, but you know, we did strike, and this is totally anecdotal, so it wasn't kind of reported formally in any way, but there were people thinking about voting between ACT and Labour in the last week of the 2020 campaign, which is an odd choice, but, you know, National was just out of the equation for them. But holding it will be really hard, and that will be largely predicated on National performance. But what I think is what's interesting about that article that you sent round, and, you know, generally is the way ACT is trying to position as broadening its influence. David Seymour at the Victoria University conference, my memories on the election is a bit vague now, but he talked about how their appeal was broadening beyond the kind of classic older, rich, Auckland white male into sort of new, younger voters, especially female voters, and he sounded much more excited about the latter audience than the former one, which sustained ACT for many years. Now, if he says he's data-driven, that's hard to know. I mean, Ben will know more than me probably whether that's kind of quite sort of sophisticated US-style data analysis, or whether he's just asked, you know, what the kind of universe is, what he referred to, of people who would consider voting ACT. And he said that's up to 33% from, you know, being much lower than that. The issue, of course, is the Greens will be about the same, and New Zealand First will probably be about 15 to 20 as well. So it adds up to more than 100 when you do that. But, I mean, that is clearly where they need to go to sort of break out from that kind of right-wing free market positioning where really they only had... yeah, you only get about 2% for that.
He used another interesting term.
I mean, we
sorry, Ben, go ahead.
I did a bit of work on ACT's slightly less successful 2017 campaign. I think we got about 0.001 or something percent. And around that time, Seymour's name recognition, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was probably about 26% in the general public. And then I think the leaked UMR poll said that his preferred PM rating now is 12%. So, you know, to go from a quarter of people knowing who you are in 4 years to an eighth of people wanting you to be the Prime Minister, you know, it's a heck of a testament to the work that he's done as leader.
Well, not only on getting your name up with things like Dancing with the Stars, right, get that profile up, but then what he's done subsequently in his political sphere. And the other point we keep saying is also managing a brand new caucus. They tend to self-destruct. There's always at least one person who just, you know, takes you down afterwards. He did use a term that I found interesting in something that I read or heard over the weekend. He was talking about meritocracy, talking about being the party for people with aspirations. Now, that's a word that Bill English and National used to trot out all the time. We're the party for aspirational New Zealanders. And what it does is highlight again that when National's gone, is less towards its kind of typical economic business messaging and off into these side issues. It's almost like they're swapping places in their messaging, Ben.
Yeah, and And part of that is because I think Seymour is now resonating as, you know, I wouldn't take his name in vain and say a more John Key-ish figure, but he is, you know, he's able to be a more relatable kind of person. So ACTIV always talked about aspiration. You know, that's always been part of their thing. But when Rodney Hyde's talking about it, it's not very inspirational because people didn't relate to Rodney Hyde to a lesser extent. The same thing with Richard Preble. David Seymour is actually much more personable and relatable, which has actually been his, you know, most astounding trick with ACT, I think, is to make, you know, this traditionally big business fat cat completing the project of Rogenomics Party, you know, give it a human face.
Well, Rodney Hyde was always running mini scandals for his headlines, and so the conversations disappeared under it. The other thing that strikes me, Stephen, you might want to comment, is that this is about a party that is a proactive and that is out there and setting the agenda it wants to set, whereas National still appears to be stuck in being reactive. To cut it some slack, if it's out doing the really hard groundwork in all its various demographics, trying to understand what its policies should look like to reflect the party its people have expected it to be all these decades, but to update its policies, well and good. But one appears to be sending out the four press releases per minute and stating what it is they're doing, and the other still appears to be doing a lot of reacting. Is that fair, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the kind of thing with that, you do need to take into account the trouble National's in, and, you know, it's not that long since the kind of Mueller issue kind of worked through and hurt National further again. I mean, it took a long time. I don't sort of buy this kind of magic so much. I think there's a lot of situational elements in it. And I certainly would like to correct the kind of dancing with the stars thing, because it was kind of years later when he started to move in the polls and he had kind of lots of 0.1 ratings after dancing with the stars before he started getting some traction. So I don't want to just warn all future politicians that that's not necessarily the way to a political career. Yeah. Yeah. I think most of them would probably be better dancers, but even then,
yeah.
I mean, what it does do is make people pay attention for the first time. And when you've got low name recognition, you've got a lot of people who think that you're somehow, you know, slightly representing malign interests. You know, it can really
make
help.
A dork of yourself can help.
Yeah, show a bit of vulnerability.
I'm not suggesting it was the turning point for his career, but first there was a little bit of name recognition, and then subsequently what he has done is build a very different brand in actually relatively recent times since no longer being a sole player. Hey, look, we'll leave it there. Really appreciate the talk. Thank you very much for the time, both of you, as always. Stephen Mills and Ben Thomas.